This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll find out how supply chain issues could affect Black Friday and holiday shopping this year and what shoppers need to know. Now, nearly 775,000 people have passed away from COVID-19 here in the United States. More than half of those deaths now have happened in 2021, with blame going to the Delta variant, in some cases relaxed public health measures, and low vaccination rates in some communities. COVID cases are going up in many Midwestern states. We're going to talk about the latest COVID news, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the current COVID situation in Wisconsin? Have you gotten a booster shot? Do you plan on getting one? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempty served on the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He's also served on the CDC's Board of Scientific Counselors. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. It is always a pleasure to join you.
Good to have you back. What are you seeing in our latest COVID numbers, especially here in Wisconsin lately?
Well, we are unfortunately seeing things increase rapidly again. So as you mentioned, across the country, it's almost 775,000. For Wisconsin, we have had nearly 860,000 cases and almost 9,000 deaths. But unfortunately, we're seeing things increase again with the cooler and shorter days.
Right. This was the bad time of year last year. Are we thinking it is just the weather and our habits and going inside again that seems to be linked to this increase?
Well, I think there is a lot of things kind of hitting all together. As you mentioned in your introduction, we have the Delta variant, which is very transmittable. Coronaviruses in general tend to like colder temperatures, you know, the shorter days and so on. So we tend to see much more activity during the winter months. One of the big things, though, is our children going back to school and having transmission occurring in that setting have really come on as our leading group in terms of the number of cases. And then, as you mentioned, relaxing on our public health measures. And unfortunately, in Wisconsin, 41% of our citizens have yet to receive any vaccine. And so I think all these together add up for the possibility of this surge coming back and taking over for the next month or so.
Let's compare and contrast the numbers we're seeing for vaccinated and unvaccinated. I keep seeing different charts, whether it's from the CDC or states or individual hospitals, and they're pretty staggering, right? The difference in hospitalizations and fatalities between the vaccinated and unvaccinated. What are we seeing?
Well, I think the most important thing I can try and carry across is how incredibly effective the vaccines have been, even in the face of waning and even in the face of the Delta variant. So looking at the data that were used by FDA to approve the booster doses, we see that individuals who had received the full complement of the mRNA vaccine and did not receive a booster dose, in that group, that was the placebo group for the study, nobody was hospitalized. There were a number of cases of infection, but they just were not serious. On the other hand, people who did get the vaccine and a booster were about 98 to 99% protected overall. So these things work really, really good. And unfortunately, as you mentioned, that we're seeing so many hospitalizations and unfortunately the predominance of death in people who are not vaccinated.
We focus a lot on the death numbers because of COVID. There are some pretty chilling accounts out there, a new one in the Gannett papers in Wisconsin, of the experiences of people who have gone through intensive care for COVID. Can you talk about the sort of things that even survivors face during their infection and some cases afterward?
Well, we're so used to seeing on television shows people who have been in a coma, for example, for a year, wake up and walk out of the hospital. And unfortunately, that's not the case. When people are in the intensive care unit, for example, on a ventilator, after a week or two on a ventilator, we start talking about doing a tracheostomy or putting a hole through the front of the throat for that ventilator. People have atrophy of muscles. Despite the best care, sometimes they develop sores or bed sores. And these are all things that require long-term rehab. People who are coming out of an intensive care unit are oftentimes looking at weeks to months of physical therapy, respiratory therapy, and other therapies to get back to where they were before they started. And this is one of those unaccounted for tolls of COVID-19, just the number of people who have this long-term recovery after a successful treatment.
Talking to Dr. John Tempte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest COVID trends and numbers. And you can join in with your questions for our guest, maybe your own experiences with COVID. How are you looking at the booster shot issue? If you're already vaccinated, if you've already gotten boosted, or are you planning to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Tempte, you mentioned kids, a part of the increase in the number of tests. We know, fortunately, kids aren't as vulnerable, it seems, to the worst effects of COVID. They're not invulnerable, but much less at risk. Now, kids under the age of 12, many of them eligible to be vaccinated. What would you say to parents who are making that decision of when and how and where to vaccinate their kids?
Well, first and foremost, when a vaccine is approved, either through the traditional licensure or through emergency use authorization, as this one was, they undergo very, very tight scrutiny in terms of the safety, making sure that we're not seeing anything that is routinely associated with a vaccine. We never know about all the safety problems until it's out there in widespread populations. But if I can just toss out, we have now across the globe had about 7.5 billion, with a B, doses of COVID vaccines out there. And we just have not seen much in the way of serious safety concerns. What we do see are rare, they're isolated, and most of the time people recover completely from these events. So first and foremost, they're safe. Number two, they're incredibly effective in preventing infection. And beyond that, preventing those awful outcomes such as the hospitalization and death. You know, children are wonderful in that we don't see the high levels of hospitalization. We see very few deaths in children, but we still see that as well. And every hospitalization, every death in a child is a preventable occurrence with this virus. And so I think we're obligated to do as much as we can to protect our children.
And Dr. Tempte, a couple new tools possibly in the works. Merck, the drug maker, applied for emergency use authorization for an antiviral COVID pill. Pfizer has one, I think, pending FDA authorization. What do we know about those drugs and what kind of difference they could make?
Well, first of all, they have names that are difficult to pronounce. Molnupiravir is the Merck drug, and Paxlovid from Pfizer. And these are both medications that will interrupt the reproduction or the replication of the COVID virus. And these are both drugs that will be most effective the earlier you start them after infection, much like the drugs we have for influenza. So it's going to be very, very important to, once these drugs are available, to assure that they get to people very, very quickly. And from the clinical trials, we're seeing that they are very, very effective. Just looking at the Pax or the Paxlovid, it was about 90% effective in preventing significant outcomes such as hospitalizations in people who had already been infected. So I think we're going to see a lot of use, but you also have to keep in mind that these drugs are going to be dependent on having ability to diagnose COVID rapidly. And so we'll have to be having sufficient tests out there, and we'll have to have a medical system that can respond. And unfortunately, across the country, what we're finding are huge numbers of people in the healthcare professions leaving their practice through burnout and through other attrition. So particularly, you know, we look at our nurses, our respiratory therapists, and people like that. We just have to take a deep breath and hope we get through this and do everything we can in terms of therapeutics and prevention to minimize the great toll this is having on our healthcare providers.
It's Brianna Caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Luck. Chris, hi.
Hi, I have a question. We had COVID go to the house, my two children and my wife. And I stayed home. I slept with my wife, and I mean, I was in proximity of it all. And I'm also a public school teacher, and I'm exposed like crazy. And I was spared COVID. I haven't got it. And just wondering if you could expand on that, why that may have been, and also wondering about your thoughts of getting a booster.
Chris, before you go, I just wanted to ask, have you had an antibody test to see if you might have had it in the past?
No, I did not.
Okay. Chris, thanks a lot. This is an interesting question. Diseases can be fluky, Dr. Tempty. It's possible he was heavily exposed and didn't get it. It's possible he might have had an asymptomatic case. A lot of luck, if you'll forgive me, Chris, could go into that, right, Dr. Tempty?
Yeah, I think you answered the question as well as I could, Rob. There could be many different reasons. You know, even, for example, we do see some people who seem to be immune to respiratory viruses in general. We see other people who tend to come down with things. So understanding the immune system is really challenging, but I think the most likely is either a prior infection that was inapparent or thought to be something else that provides that protection going forward. That being said, if somebody has not been vaccinated previously, we would recommend doing the full course of any one of the three vaccines that are currently approved in the United States.
Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. We're talking about COVID-19 with Dr. John Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts, questions, or experiences to share about COVID, vaccines for kids, boosters for the grownups? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation. Take some more of your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now about the latest COVID news with Dr. John Tempty from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Randy, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Yes, I'm a person that tested positive last year in October, quarantined. I think I might have been like asymptomatic. I didn't have hardly any symptoms, just runny nose and a little bit of a headache, fortunately. So I've had all three shots of the Moderna vaccine, that my booster net. And I was wondering, what's my possibilities of transmitting it on to my grandchildren if I come in contact with anybody?
Randy, thanks for the call. His risk, Dr. Tempty.
Excellent question. The answer is very, very low. I can't say that it's impossible, but we do know that you have had now four different exposures to this virus or parts of the virus through infection and vaccination. And compared to somebody who has not had any of that, your risk of contracting COVID is very, very low. And if you do, the amount of virus that would be in your secretions, in your cough or sneeze, would tend to be very, very low as well. So I think this is why we see CDC recommendations, and more locally here in Dane County, for example, with our public health order for masking, saying that you don't need to mask if you're fully vaccinated and around people who are also either vaccinated or who are at low risk. So I think I would go forward without having a whole lot of concern about that risk for transmission.
Randy, thanks a lot. It's a great question. And Dr. Tepti, that's a good opportunity to ask you a question I'm guessing a lot of people are asking you. Thanksgiving, what would you say is a good, safe get-together?
Well, Thanksgiving is traditionally the kickoff period for respiratory viruses, or the more significant ones like influenza. And when you consider that on this coming Sunday, I've heard 3 million people are going to be traveling, and we're associating toddlers and elderly people and everybody in between, and we're bringing college students home from the campus, and we're all mingling. And at the same time, keep in mind that that definition of a close exposure that we all knew very well last year was spending 15 minutes within 6 feet of somebody. And think about the football game, think about sitting around the table. This is an ideal setup for transmission. And so, number one, trying to have everybody vaccinated would be a wonderful idea. If not vaccinated, if people are able to test before they travel, that's a good idea as well. If you have concerns, you know, trying to spread people out a little bit, you know, I hate to say this, but in some situations where you're just not sure, or you're immunocompromised, or concerned about your own health, wearing a mask can be beneficial. And then I think the other things to keep in mind, and this might be the most important, if you are feeling sick yourself, stay away and expect that of other people as well. So those are kind of the guidelines. We're looking forward to a Thanksgiving far larger than last year, but I'm happy to say that everybody in our party, people who are coming over to our house, I think we're 100% vaccinated. And also, a number of us are tested fairly frequently as part of a surveillance program. So we're feeling pretty good this year.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jay is with us in Milwaukee. Jay, hello.
Hey, hello.
What did you want to ask about, Jay? Yep, go for it.
Well, you know how on the arm that gets shot sometimes, you can get in the armpit, you can get a soreness. Rare, but they said it's okay, it's normal, last a couple months, but it's been 4 months and I still got a soreness. And that's just my general question. Also, I've been holding off. That was in July I got it, beginning of July. So now it's November, it's still sore. Now, I've heard the comment that opinion that that's normal, it's a sign it's working and everything, and that's great. So, but my just general, that's the general situation and question is that okay? It's been 4 months, and I'm holding off on the booster because I don't, you know, I'm waiting for this to kind of go away or something.
And Jake, can I ask which shot you got? Because it matters for the timing of the booster.
Moderna, I believe.
Moderna. Okay, thanks for the call. So 6 months, I think, is the wait on that, Dr. Tepti, but that soreness, that pain afterward.
Yeah, we do know that the Moderna vaccine has a little bit higher rate of swelling of the lymph nodes, and sometimes that can be pretty significant, but it tends to be transient, so lasting a few days to a week or two. So I would think that 3 to 4 months is pretty prolonged. And with that, I would suggest being seen by your care provider just to make sure something else is not going on with that.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing that. Good luck to you. We'll go to Jason now in Bloomer. Jason, hi.
Hi, everybody. Hey, so I've got 5 boys. We were sitting down to dinner today, and I got a positive result back for one of my kids who had an exposure in school. None of them are vaccinated yet because, of course, that just kind of came out. Mm-hmm. Me, my wife, and my father-in-law, we all live in the same house, and we're all vaccinated. But I guess my question is, what is the time frame on actual quarantine in this situation? Because, of course, one can get it, the next one can get it after that. And I guess we have a trip planned in about a month, and we're trying to see if we need to cancel that or kind of what that looks like.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Jason. Dr. Tepti, what do you say to him?
Yeah, well, I'm really sorry to hear that as well. And from studies that my group has done here at the University of Wisconsin, we're able to show that, you know, in almost half the households that we've looked at, when there's one case, basically the entire household will become ill with COVID-19 within a two-week period. And so a couple thoughts here. So the current quarantine recommendations would be about 10 days after that exposure. And I would argue that within a household situation like you're describing, we're not worried about one kid getting sick and then a week later, the next kid and a chain like that. This is going to be occurring much more rapidly. That being said, there's still an opportunity, I think, just to go ahead and get anybody who is eligible vaccinated. There would be no harm in vaccination, even if there was an exposure going on. And we do know that within 7 to 14 days after that first dose, we start seeing significant benefits of that vaccine. So if you're looking at a travel plan coming up in a month, that would be my suggestion.
All right. Good luck to you and your family, Jason. Dr. Tepti, I want to take a minute. A couple of things we've talked about here today would be helped out, those antiviral pills, Jason's situation, if we had more access to rapid testing. Are we getting more of that online now in just our last minute or so?
Yeah, there are many more tests out there. The thing to keep in mind is the rapid tests don't perform real well for people who have low levels of virus, but they still are a good tool to have. And I think this is going to be an area of rapid increase of technology coming into the long haul with this virus. And unfortunately, I think we're going to be in the long haul with this virus. It's not going to be going away. We won't defeat it, but we're going to have to learn how to live with it. And the way we live with that is the testing, hopefully the rapid testing, the availability of multiple tools such as the antivirals, the vaccines, and good common sense to try and get on top of this.
Dr. Tepti, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you so much, and have a very happy Thanksgiving. Take care now.
You too. That's Dr. John Tepti, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tepti served on the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and on the CDC Board of Scientific Counselors. Coming up tomorrow at 11, it's a Thanksgiving Day special from The Splendid Table. It's Turkey Confidential. Get last-minute advice, rescue and repair help for your Thanksgiving meal, or just entertainment by the problems other people are having with their meals. That's Turkey Confidential. That's tomorrow at 11 here on the Ideas Network. This year's Grammy nominations came out this week. There are big names in the mix, including the Taylor Swifts and Kanye Wests of the world, and of course, lots of younger acts as well. There's been a lot of attention for a group of fresh-faced kids getting their first Grammy nomination for their obscure Swedish band called ABBA. Yes, ABBA got its first nomination and could win the award 40 years after they became a band. No, I did the math wrong. 50 years after they became a band. They did okay without a Grammy, two Billboard number one songs along the way, a number of other hits. And depending on how you reckon it, they're in the top 30 best-selling musical acts of all time. They're nominated for a new single, I Still Have Faith in You. Do they have a chance? This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Biden says the U.S. will tap into the emergency oil supply to lower gas prices. We'll look at what's causing them to go up, how much Biden's move may or may not help, and what else it could take to bring them back down. Now, the holiday shopping weekend is on the way, but the retail market is still grappling with supply chain disruptions and inflation. Could mean fewer deals and fewer in-stock items for Black Friday shoppers. We're finding out what issues retailers are dealing with right now and how it could affect holiday gift giving. Marco Bastel is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Supply Chain Management at Marquette University. Marco, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob, and thank you for inviting me.
There's been a lot of talk about supply chain concerns when it comes to, you know, whether that holiday gift, say, we want to buy is going to be on a shelf or a website or not. What kind of supply chain problems are you looking at that could tilt things one way or another?
Well, what's happening is we are dealing with what we would call an end-to-end decrease in the capacity to manufacture on one hand, but more importantly, to move and store the goods. So a lot of goods that we are shopping for now at this holiday time, right, is coming from Asia. And it's important, you know, to have the capacity actually to store them, to move them then into the hands of the end consumer. And workers are still getting ill. We don't have enough truck drivers. We have a issues in ports, we have issues in rails, and all this is actually impacting the product availability.
Now, I'm seeing some big retail chains saying, hey, don't worry, we got out early, we've managed to stock up on a lot of key holiday-type goods. Is this something that consumers are going to see and feel that much, do you think?
Yes. So what particularly big retailers did throughout the year, they started with something what we call stockpiling. So they put their orders in early in the preparation for the holiday season and in the light of anticipation of the supply chain issues. So a result of that is that for sure we won't experience disruptions to such a great scale that we could if that wouldn't be done. But still, for certain products, we may experience delayed delivery times. Some shelves may be a little bit empty here and there. But overall, as a consumers, we will experience a little bit higher prices than if we compare this with the last year.
This is a global problem, as you mentioned, from manufacturing to delivery to the store shelf at all points in between. That said, do you think there are actions that a national government, say the United States government, could be taking, maybe even has taken, that can help get things flowing again?
Yeah, so the one that we all know about it is government actually helping the LA port to be open 24/7. That unfortunately will not help much, or at least it has not produced the same effect as we were hoping. The reason is that we have a lot of issues to move the product after the port. So for example, here to move the product here in Midwest, in our hands, let's say here in Milwaukee area, you have to offload the container in the port, you have to put it on a train, you have to then store it somewhere in between, you have to put it on a truck, in a distribution center, in a van, and so on. And throughout this entire chain, we are experiencing what we call loss of capacity. Workers are still getting sick. We don't have enough truck drivers. Warehouses are full, as well as we are experiencing shortage of empty containers. And that all contributes to slowing down the flow.
There are concerns about inflation, some big numbers coming up when it comes to what people end up paying for products. How much of the inflation story do you see coming from the supply chain story that we're talking about?
It's an important contributing factor, right? And I think it's going to impact the inflation rate for as long as the issues persist in the supply chain. How much percentage-wise is difficult to say, but for sure I can say it's a contributing factor.
How much of this is going to be a short-term problem versus how much do you think this is revealing bigger systemic problems that we may be dealing with for, I don't know, years?
That's a very good question. I think short-term, we'll just have to wait for pressure on supply chains to decrease, particularly after the new year when demand starts going down. So we'll be seeing issues lingering well into the second half of 2022. But long-term, companies really have to ask themselves, is it the way we manage our supply chains and how we are designing them and what we are emphasizing, particularly in the last 3 to 4 decades, the key factor that companies were emphasizing was efficiency, right? And that's one of the reasons why we have such a long supply chains, inflexible supply chains that are also very susceptible to disruptions. And some of these will have to change in the future. We will have to rethink how we are managing supply chains, because suddenly this has become a board level discussions, a CEO level discussion. And I'm looking forward actually to see what how companies will react after that short-term issues actually fade away.
That's something I've been wondering about, because I've seen people mm-hmm. point toward just-in-time production models getting disrupted by this. Do you expect those boards to actually make these changes, or is this going to be a case where, oh, things go back to normal a year from now, and we're just going to go back to that old way of doing things because when things work well, it's cheaper?
Yeah. Great question. You know, we have to see. This is exactly what happened, for example, with disruptions related to 2011 earthquake in Japan. Automotive industry, for example, was quite badly affected. And one of the things that they did was adding more safety stock in their supply chains, shift from single to dual sourcing. That becomes a little bit more expensive. And I know that some of the automotive producers actually reversed some of their decisions back, which is they're hurting them now. So we have to see whether the pain that we are experiencing during this pandemic was actually strong enough that that's going to be something that people, particularly management in corporations, will actually remember and start taking risk and resilience in supply chains more seriously than we haven't until now.
And Marco, as we wrap up, for holiday shoppers out there, we heard stores stocked up early. Are you mm-hmm. recommending people start looking for things early, or maybe just be a little more flexible than we might have been in years past?
Yes. So my first recommendation would be for sure start early. But given the extent of the issues we are dealing with, I think a little bit of patience and perhaps managing our expectations, what products will be available and what products may not be, that can go a long way as well.
Marco, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Marco Bastl is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Supply Chain Management at Marquette University. He joined us for a look at holiday shopping and how it could be affected by problems in the global retail supply chain. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about home renovation and hidden treasure.
You never know what you might find once you start renovating an old home, but that can be half the fun. Author Ron Davis thinks building and renovating are acts of faith, and he shares this story of odd coincidence and wishful thinking.
Anyone who's done serious renovation of an older home, ripping down lath and plaster, wrestling with stubborn 2x4s, and prying up floorboards, has probably harbored the fantasy of finding some kind of long hidden treasure. Civil War medals, a moth-eaten bag of precious coins, possibly a secret diary full of scandalous confessions. Unfortunately, what is often discovered are crumbling foundations, rotted timbers, and plumbing issues, if not a desiccated mouse or two. But sometimes a do-it-yourselfer finds a shoe. Through an amazing coincidence, two of my friends living 200 miles apart in Wisconsin told me shoe discovery stories. One was Celia, who found a dainty little girl's shoe in the recess above a window she and her husband Paul were replacing in their 1890s farmhouse in Amherst. The shoe was worn through, the leather cracked, but the cunning button hooks that ran up the side and its pointed toe still conveyed the elegance of old-world craftsmanship. Celia was fascinated with the shoe, both for the mystery of how it came to be there and the history of its owner. A high school art teacher, she added the shoe to her collection of objects to be sketched by her students, and then, 20 years later, passed the shoe on to the new owners of her home when she and her family moved. Another friend, Joe, has a reputation in his small town of Marshall for treasuring all things old. In fact, he and his wife, Carrie, have devoted a good share of their life to renovating a small hotel built there in 1873 as their family's home. A neighbor down the street who was rehabbing his own 100-year-old home told Joe, "You're going to like this," and pointed to a toolbox holding a well-worn girl's boot he had found between two wall studs. Since retirement from a clinical psychology practice, Joe has devoted himself to charitable pursuits, repairing and repurposing antique furniture for auctions and fundraisers. He saw a different possibility for the shoe, offering a $250 scholarship competition to Marshall High English students who wanted to try writing an essay, poem, or story about the shoe, now property of the Marshall Historical Society. Though 30 years separated my hearing the two shoe stories, it felt like too much of a coincidence, and a little light research revealed it wasn't. Placing a shoe in a wall, a floor, behind a chimney, or above a door during construction is a tradition that dates back to the 12th century. Largely a European practice, particularly in the UK, shoes were even placed beneath the choir stalls in England's Winchester Cathedral, circa 1304. Building historians guess the concealed shoes originally served as magical charms to ward off witches, demons, and ghosts. Those shoes placed under a bedroom floor may have been associated with fertility. Think old woman who lived in a shoe. Which may also explain why shoes are traditionally tied to the bumpers of newlyweds' cars. In America, hiding a child's shoe in the wall was a strong tradition, mainly in the Northeast. But apparently the custom was carried all the way to the Midwest, before evidently dying out in the mid-20th century. Superstition or quaint custom, I see concealing a shoe in a wall as a poignant symbol of faith, of the confidence, and of the risks that lie behind anyone's notion to build or renovate a home. A concealed child's shoe, scuffed, cracked, and worn, is like the penny tossed into a fountain, a talisman of hope.
Ron Davis is a retired English teacher and the author of Shiny Side Up, Musings on the Improbable Inclination to Travel on Two Wheels. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll find out what's driving up gas prices and the White House's latest moves to try and bring them down. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, hear about unique Thanksgiving food traditions from around the U.S. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, according to AAA, more than 48 million Americans are expected to travel by car over the Thanksgiving holiday, nearly a million of those from Wisconsin. It's up from last year, still down from pre-pandemic levels by about 8%. And it's going to cost more than last year. The average price of a gallon of gas in Wisconsin is $3.15. A year ago, $2. The price of gas has been higher in the past, in 2008 and 2014, for example. President Biden announced this week that he's releasing 50 million barrels of oil from the emergency stockpile to bring prices down. He said other countries will be reaching into their reserves as well.
And while our combined actions will not solve the problem of high gas prices overnight, it will make a difference. It will take time, but before long, you should see the price of gas drop where you fill up your tank.
Jim Ritterbusch is president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm based in Galena, Illinois. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
We're seeing gas prices now highest level since 2014. What is driving that?
Well, it's always an array of factors that drive strong upward trends in gasoline. We've had very strong demand. We've had strong crude prices all year that contribute to about half of the increase in gasoline values. And refineries have been slow to recover this year following last year's pandemic. So it's a combo of factors, but, you know, it's a situation where demand has been quite strong this year, at least in comparison with last. And when you have demand this strong, it's partially a function of a strong economy. So we have a strong economy that boosts gasoline prices at the end of the day.
Was there an anticipation in the early days of the pandemic that demand was going to be down for a long time with the economic disruption that maybe didn't pan out as being as long a slump as people had thought?
Yeah, most analysts were behind the curve in anticipating just how fast this U.S. economy plus other economies around the globe would be able to rebound. So the recovery has been quite robust, and that's found a reflection to a large extent in a record high stock market, and it's also been a contributor to a strong inflationary pace overall.
So here we have this strategic reserve. Before we get into the impact tapping into that might have, can you tell us what is this and why do we have it?
It's a store of crude. It's stored mainly in these large salt caverns down in Louisiana and Texas regions. And it was constructed or devised years ago when we were very dependent upon OPEC production. So they came up with a plan to store crude in these caverns, and that that supply, I believe at one time, was over 700 million barrels, and it's down around 600 million barrels presently.
So here we have 50 million barrels here in the U.S. We're going to tap into that. Other countries, so we hear China, India, and others also tapping into their reserves. How much of an impact does do you think that'll have on oil prices and then gas prices?
Well, if you looked at the futures market in the past 2 days, you would say not much. Subsequent to the headlines that came out yesterday regarding a SPR release, futures popped almost $2 a barrel in crude oil. So this was a classic case of the old stock market adage of selling the rumor and buying the news. And as a result, we've boosted gasoline futures several cents, and that'll find some reflection at the pump here with a lag of 1 or 2 weeks.
Now, President Biden had also suggested that, hey, maybe there's some more profit taking in the industry than there should be, saying, hey, look, oil prices went down a bit, but gas prices didn't follow. Is there anything to that?
There's always this lag. Crude prices come down, and I would say you're looking at two and a half weeks before you start to see impact at the retail gasoline level. So that's what we've seen. Plus, gasoline futures tend to come off in tandem with crude oil, and at one point they were down almost 20 cents since the beginning of this month. So you'll see some of that pass through or filter through into the retail gasoline channel. So we should see a little bit more relief, but not much.
So we see prices going up on oil, Jim. I guess my Econ 101 would say that means if I'm selling oil, I'm going to try to produce more of it to make more money, and that's going to drive prices down. Is it that simple?
It was that simple until the past year or so. And major oil companies increased what we call this shale production considerably in recent years. And then their stocks really didn't perform. And as a result, generally, they adopted a strategy of plowing cash back into stock buybacks, trying to boost stock market returns to their shareholders. And they paid very little attention to growing production. So in other words, it's been a value over growth scenario that's transpired here this year. And as a result, production is just moving up very gradually and hasn't kept pace with this strong path of demand that I alluded to previously.
So what are you watching for? I mean, it'll cost more for this Thanksgiving holiday travel season. What are you watching for, say, in the months to come?
A wild card that I see in the months to come is the COVID. We're seeing a dramatic increase in Europe, especially in Austria, in COVID-19. And as a result, we've seen some lockdowns and restrictions in Europe. And if that spreads, that's going to be a major demand deterrent. So the good news is it would put downside pressure on gasoline prices, but at the same time, that's not a good reason to reduce gasoline prices.
And then what are you watching for with OPEC in particular, and whether they're going to ramp up production? I've heard even thoughts that they might bring it down to balance out these strategic stockpile releases. What are you watching for there?
We'll get a better view at the end of next week, a week from tomorrow. They have their monthly meeting. And there is a possibility that they could attempt to retaliate by reducing the their planned or their scheduled production increases that amount to about 400,000 barrels a month. So it's a tough call. My feeling is that they're going to maintain the status quo. I don't think they want to get into a food fight with the White House over trying to keep prices up as opposed to the effort of the United States and some allies that are trying to press them down. So I don't see that scenario playing out myself. So I think that there's a strong chance that they'll simply stay with their plan, boost production another 400,000 a month to be announced next week. And from there, we'll see if that can begin to catch up with this strong pace of demand.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Have a nice Thanksgiving.
You too. That's Jim Ritterbusch with Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm in Galena, Illinois, talking about the recent rise in gas prices. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there can be a lot of value in friendships with people from different generations. Find out why and hear stories of people who made friends across the ages. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then in school board debates across the country, some parents are pushing for more control over what schools teach and how they teach it. But how much say do they really have? We'll talk to an education historian about that and other times schools have faced a backlash throughout history. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.